Aloha, welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm D.W. Gibson, sitting in for Catherine Cruz. Lahaina Harbor is in a soft reopening, but some want to apply the brakes. We hear from one sailing company owner who is excited about a return to business. And the island of Hawaii has a new name, simply Hawaii. We hear about the reason for the change and get reactions. A new report shows that small businesses are having a hard time filling jobs. We look into the numbers. We meet a small water bird with a distinctive face on this week's Manu Minute. And where did all the civics classes go? We hear about a new school initiative that tries to get students excited about the importance of participating in democracy. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Lahaina's small boat harbor has officially reopened. The harbor sustained $30 million in damage from the August 8th wildfires. Monday marked the first time since the fires that boats were permitted to resume commercial operations. The limited reopening marked a milestone in West Maui's recovery, but some say the area is not yet ready for visitors. Protesters at the harbor say it is too soon and that their perspectives have not been taken into account by the county. This morning, The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Don Prestige, the president of Sail Maui. His company is one of four expected to resume operations out of the harbor during the limited reopening. He starts with some background on the business.
We have three boats, two that have historically been out of Lahaina Harbor and one out of Ma'alai Harbor. We had probably 40 employees before. At the time, we ran, you know, mostly we ran two trips a day on our boats, like a snorkeling trip and then some type of afternoon or sunset sail. And then since the fire, we've been running two boats out of Ma'alai Harbor, and one boat hasn't been running at all.
And what's the impact been on business?
It's pretty drastic. Yeah, we're down significantly since before the fire. We didn't lay anybody off. A lot of people left after the fire. And then we've been just doing the best we can to keep, like, we've been trying to keep our operations running enough where we can keep our employees on healthcare, the ones that we have.
And so when did you hear about Lahaina Harbor reopening in limited capacity?
They've been talking about it for quite some time now. There was like a, I think that was like this summer was the first talk of reopening it. And then they pushed it until now. But it's been going on for months. It's a limited reopening. There's no power down there, so there's no lights. And so there's limited hours and really specific parking. But other than that, you know, our boats used to use the loading dock. We're called VMEs, which means vessel moored elsewhere. So our boats stay out on moorings and come in and use the main loading dock. The main loading dock and the, they call it the ferry dock, usually are both intact. And so we'll be using that like we used to use it.
Why is Lahaina Harbor important for your company to use?
Well, right now, I'd say Ma'alai Harbor is just, it's really overcrowded right now because they've allowed, you know, us and other boats to move some of our operations there and maintain those operations. And then Lahaina Harbor is just such a beautiful place. You know, it's a great place. Our boats, we like to sail. It's a great place for sailing. And yeah, people have always had a love for Lahaina Harbor.
Would you be able to summarize what's been going on, what your experience has been if you've been down there in the past few days? Any pushback?
I think there's really mixed feelings on if it's the harbor's ready to be open. And some people have come down, as they should, to let those voices be heard. So it's been nice. It's been peaceful. And I think it is important that everybody gets to express themselves. But yeah, not everybody's ready for it, which is totally understandable.
And what's your perspective? These are difficult topics.
I agree. It's difficult. And I definitely do not have all the answers. And we're trying to decide for ourselves, you know, the best way for us to fit in to the community as a whole. And so we're not taking these decisions lightly. They're important decisions. And we're getting as much counsel as we can from different leaders and people in the community, and we're going to try and continue to make decisions that have the best impact on our community. We think our business is important as well, but there's definitely a bigger picture, and we hopefully are doing the best we can.
Would you say that one of the things that is delicate here is visitors and tourists going back into an area that hasn't necessarily been open or encouraged that the public go to?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is sacred ground. And definitely for us that live in Lahaina, this is sacred ground. And I can understand that people are not ready or won't be ready for a long time. And I can also understand that there needs to be a time to move forward. And hopefully we're doing that the best way we can do it. It's difficult. It's not lost on us that it's a difficult time. And being one of the first businesses, we understand that, you know, we're going to be in the spotlight and the crosshairs, and hopefully we find a way to do it with grace and do it in a way where we honor the community and the history of this place.
And what do you feel like your responsibility, like your kuleana, is to educate visitors and make sure that the sacred ground you talk about, that is respected?
Yeah, this is absolutely important to us. And so we're starting with, we've shot a video that we're going to be sending out with our confirmation emails. We're almost finished it, where we say just that, like, come back with mindfulness and reverence, save your photos and your videos until you get on the boat. And we're just inviting tourists to come back. If they want to be part of the journey forward, they need to come back with that type of aloha and respect. And then our crew's been doing sensitivity training and cultural training. Our procedures, we're going to ask our guests to meet us in the parking lot, and we're going to escort them back and forth. And then when we're on the boat, when the captain does the safety briefing and when they leave, we're just going to try and continue to share the message that this is, you know, to please just be respectful, be mindful for what this place is for the people that live here.
And I imagine there might also be environmental concerns. You do whale watching tours. I spoke recently with a researcher who said that they have some preliminary data that suggests that with Lahaina Harbor closed, the whales have actually been spotted closer to the shore. So have you been seeing anything like that, or what are your protocols?
Yeah, I didn't know if that was proven, but I live in Lahaina and I've noticed that the last 2 years that the whales are close. So that they seem like they're coming in very close. I think the whale watch boats, and when we do whale watches, we're very mindful and respectful of the rules around that and keeping our distance and keeping our engines off if the whales do choose to come close. So being, you know, again, this is very sensitive and there's lots of different ways to look at it. But I think that one way is that for visitors to see whales on a boat where we're in control of the situation is probably better than them going out and doing it on their own. So we carry some responsibility there.
I guess what it boils down to is when you talk about folks in the community being ready or not for redevelopment, for letting visitors and tourists back in, how do you feel like you got to a place where you felt ready?
It's a great question, and we're still trying to figure that out. In a lot of ways, you know, we're still trying to figure it out, but in a lot of ways we feel it's our responsibility not to take anything away from what happened to Lahaina. But where we are today, there's also an opportunity to have a reset on what the visitor industry could look like. And I know some people don't even want to see a visitor industry, and I understand that. But for those that do want to see a visitor industry, there's a opportunity to reset what that might look like, where we ask our guests to be good tourists. And so we feel that we have the opportunity to do, you know, to do better than has been done in the past, and to set that as our standard. We're here for the conversations. We're here for the, even if they're uncomfortable and difficult conversations, and we'll continue to be, and hopefully we can continue to shape ourselves into, you know, a small business that is responsive to the needs of the community as a whole.
Any hopes or expectations for this week? If the weather clears up, you'll go?
Yeah, you know, it's both, I think, our team and our crew, all of us, I think we're excited to be running again. It is just so nice to have our boats back home. And we're also, I think everybody's nervous and aware of what it means. And yeah, it's with mixed emotions. We're coming back.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
The only thing, like, if I could say one of the things that we want to do or that we are doing is we're taking one of our sales on Saturday nights and we're dedicating it to a community sale. So we're inviting our people from Lahaina to come out complimentary. They can reach out to us on our website or our email. And we're just going to keep that open for as long as people, you know, want to go out and sail with us. So it's one thing we're going to do. We're just trying to spread the word on that.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Sail Maui President Don Prestige talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about the limited reopening of Lahaina Harbor to four companies. The Department of Land and Natural Resources says a handful more plan to resume operations from the harbor in 2026.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, developing tailored energy conservation solutions. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
The thing that made him lovable, Rob Reiner, was that he really believed in the fundamental goodness of people no matter what. You know, it's an impossible situation for a parent to turn your back on a child. You know, those movies were this man.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
We crave connections. It's human nature to want to know what's happening in your community, in the news, and with each other. And we need those connections now more than ever. Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio helps keep you connected, engaged, and enriched. Wherever you are, whatever's happening in the world, stay connected on the HPR app or ask your smart speaker to play Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
The State Board of Geographic Names has voted to change the official name of one of our main islands. The island of Hawaii, as it's known in state documents, will now simply be Hawaii. Joining us to talk about this change and share a few names for Hawaii that you may not know is HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning.
So tell us, what motivated the board to change the island's name?
So I talked about this with Marcus Hanalei-Marzan. He's a cultural advisor for the Bishop Museum, and he's also one of the volunteer board members. And he told me that part of it was just about consistency in naming conventions across the islands. So it isn't, you know, the island of Oahu. It's just Oahu, and same goes for Maui, Molokai, Lanai, Kauai, Niihau, and now Hawaii. But that wasn't the only thing that motivated the board. Marzan, who voted in favor of the change, said that there was this feeling that Hawaii is the name of the island, and that's what it should be called. And he says that the name Hawaii reflects the movement of people through Polynesia, because there are other islands within the Pacific that have really similar names.
The old name of Raiatea in French Polynesia was Hawaiki. And there's an island in Samoa. It's called Savai'i. There are these ancestral names that have been carried across the Pacific. And I believe Hawaii is one of those names that have been carried across and given to this island in this manner.
Right. So names carry weight. And this is a subtle change, island of Hawaii to simply Hawaii. But change certainly isn't everyone's strongest suit. So how are people reacting to this?
That's a really good point. And actually, the board first took up this issue more than a year ago. And then when that proposal came out, there was some concern among the community. And some of that boiled down to how broadly is this name change going to be applied? People said, wait a minute, am I still allowed to say Island of Hawaii if I want to? Or could I use a completely different name for the island, like Moku'okeawe or Big Island? And Marzon wants to assure people that the application of this name change is actually quite narrow. So Hawaii is now the official name in terms of how the island is identified in state and legal documents. And that's pretty much it. He says in all other contexts, people are welcome to do what they wish.
You know, there were a lot of conversations back and forth about the island having a very special place in their heart, and they have the right to identify it in the way that they feel appropriate. And we completely agree with that statement, that every member of the community has their own individual right to identify places in the way that they are most comfortable with and have the most meaning for them.
But Hawaii Island shares its name with the state, and there are other examples of this, New York and so forth. But are there thoughts on how that might be confusing?
Yeah, I mean, sure, that's why Hawaii had the designation Island of to begin with. But most of the people that I talk to feel that that really isn't an issue. So, for instance, Bobby Kamara, he's a lifelong Hawaii Island resident, and he supports this name change. And he got interested in Inoa Aina, or place names, during his career with the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. And he thinks people will just kind of figure it out if you're talking about the island or the state from context.
So if I say I am from and born in Hawaii, okay, that to me, in Hawaii means the state. On Hawaii means this island. The name of this island, as far as everybody knows, is Hawaii. That is, as far as we know, the traditional name of this island. Okay, Hawaii, that's a word in, and a name in Olelo Hawaii. Island of or island by itself are English words. They don't have anything to do with the Hawaiian language. They're English. Can we just get rid of island and of because they're not Hawaiian?
So he sees this as really straightforward, but if you did want to distinguish Hawaii, the island, from Hawaii, the state, another thing that you could do is try using one of the other Hawaiian names for the island. So there's Moku'okeawe, which means Island of Keawe, an ancestor of Kamehameha and a really powerful ali'i. That's a name you'll commonly hear people use on the island. Another name for Hawaii that I just learned reporting this story was explained to me by Hawaii geographer Drew Kapp.
Because I'm like a geography person who's enamored with landscapes, there's a beautiful epithet, I guess that's what it's called. It's actually an Ololonoia or proverbs, or like poetical sayings, which is Hawaii Kuauli or Hawaii Nui Kuauli, which is like Hawaii, this island, of the like verdant back. The kua is the back and uli is this like deep, beautiful, dark, vibrant color. And to me, that actually is like a really beautiful and fitting image of Hawaii, the island. So if people wanted to make a distinction, that would be actually the one that I would advocate if people need to make a specify which Hawaii is being referred to. It's Hawaii Kuauli. It's such a beautiful word too.
Another professor that I talked to, Akea Makamai Kayuna, she teaches Olelo Hawaii and Hawaiian Studies at Hawaii Community College. And she told me she uses all these names, Hawaii, Moku'okeawe, Hawaii Kuauli with her students. And it's really depending on what she's teaching on a given day.
And it's kind of like how us as people, we have different names depending on different contexts that we're in with family, with friends, professionally and whatnot. But it helps to give us a more holistic view of maybe who we are as a person, and knowing these different names of the island allows us to have a more holistic view of this place of Hawaii, this island that's named Hawaii. And knowing all these different names opens us up to interacting with this island in different contexts.
There is, I will say, one name that Kiuna tells her students not to use if they can help it for Hawaii, the island.
Interesting. What's that one?
So this is what most people call the island. It's Big Island.
Big Island. I was going to guess Big Island.
Yeah. So Big Island is one. And this was kind of consistent among the Olelo Hawaii speakers and cultural practitioners that I worked with. They just don't feel like Big Island captures these other poetic understandings or historical lineages of the islands. They find it to be a little diminutive. And as other people have pointed out, it's not Hawaiian. Big Island, they're both English words. And that seems like something that a lot of people are trying to move away from. But at the end of the day, this name change, this formal name change officially to Hawaii, that is just for state documents. So whatever you feel is most appropriate for your use, whatever you want to call the island, go for it.
Yeah, well, and the idea of calling it Big Island, that really taps into what Bobby Camaro was talking about there, right? I mean, that's bringing in language and ideas that are distinctly not Hawaiian and sort of superimposing those on the aina and the people itself.
Certainly. And I think also I want to point out about the board, if people want to express that they want these other names for Hawaii to be used, Moku o Ke Awe or Hawaii Kuauli, they can take that to the Hawaii Board on Geographic Names, and the board will take the public's and the community's feedback into consideration when making these decisions.
Yeah, interesting. Well, one last question. You grew up on Hawaii. Share your thoughts with us on this name change. How do you like to refer to the land on which you grew up?
I use Hawaii, and I'm trying to incorporate these other uses, Moku o Ke Awe and Hawaii Kuauli, into my dialects as well. And I think it's really cool to be able to tell this story over the radio because you can actually hear these names. That's one of the aspects that I think is powerful about what we do is when we're sharing stories, we're sharing them not just through the written word, but as they sound. And so it's great to hear like the cadence of these names and be able to incorporate them into the work that I do.
I agree. Always fun to discover new names. I'm going to start working on my pronunciation now so I can do these beautiful names justice. Thanks so much, Savannah, for taking the time to talk with us about this today.
Thank you, DW.
We've been talking to Savannah Herrmann-Pote about the State Board on Geographic Names voting to change the name of the island of Hawaii to simply Hawaii. You can read Savannah's stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. A recent report from the National Federation of Independent Business shows that small businesses are struggling to fill job openings, not just here in Hawaii, but across the country. Michael Yosua is the Hawaii State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business and the state's highest paid lobbyist. We recently talked with him about the report as well as other concerns he sees throughout the small business community. So we have a new report from the National Federation of Independent Business about employment by small business owners. What are your top lines from this report? What stands out to you about this report?
I think the biggest top line is there's labor shortages. There's up to 33% of businesses nationwide that are looking to hire people, have job openings that they couldn't fill. So definitely a strong market for people looking to get new jobs.
Well, in terms of relativity over time, it's up 1 point from October and the first increase since June. How should we interpret that sort of medium range information? No increase for several months, but then seemingly a fairly small increase.
Yeah, and we also got to remember that it's seasonally adjusted. So there's always going to be a little bit of an increase around the holidays for temporary workers and the increase in, especially with retail establishments and restaurants. But I think it's important to note that it's about 9% above the historical average of 24%. So there's been a steady, ever since about same time last year, there's been a steady demand for workers.
So a new normal, if you will, moving from 24% is something of a baseline to 33% that we seem to absorb this sort of high 30s percentage. But that sounds like a lot more of a burden.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people that run small businesses, especially, they're really tied to how the labor market and what the demand out there in the labor market is. And so if they want to expand, they want to bring on new businesses, they want to open up new stores or different divisions, they can't do it until they find workers. So again, great market if you're wanting to jump into the labor market or find a new job, but it is a little bit of a hindrance to businesses that are looking to expand.
Small business owners in the report point to labor quality as one of the prevailing issues. How should we interpret that? And what do you think can be done about that specific point of labor quality?
Yeah, I think there's a number of factors. As a small business owner, noticing that the quality of job applicants is remaining a concern, I think it could be a factor of also the limited number of workers out there. So if the number of workers is going down for the qualified amount, you're going to be looking to the unqualified to fill roles to the extent you can and maybe train them up. But again, overall, there's a shortage of workers. So it's both the skilled and the unskilled and also the qualified and unqualified. But it's not necessarily to say that, you know, people are just not as qualified as they were before, but you're looking to fill roles where qualified people aren't available. You're going to have to fill them somehow.
The numbers in this report are not broken down by state, but you're the most prominent lobbyist in Hawaii working with small businesses. In your own day-to-day experience talking to business owners and your own experience as a business owner, do you sense any deviation in these numbers for Hawaii, or does it feel like these numbers are pretty representative of the reality on the ground in our state?
Yeah, I'd say they're pretty accurate in terms of our state. You know, I don't have any specific numbers for Hawaii, but anecdotally, talking to colleagues, talking to NFIB members, talking to other business owners, everyone's in the same position. If you're looking for especially a qualified, skilled applicant, you may have a job posting on for 6 months and not be able to hire anyone during that time.
What is the association looking for in the state here in terms of help from the state government? From your perspective, what moves from legislators would be helpful and what would do more harm than good?
Well, I think there's an overall attempt by the state to improve workforce development, to get into high schools and start training programs, especially in skilled trades, supporting the college, University of Hawaii, Chaminade, whatever other colleges that are willing to train folks that are willing to stay in Hawaii and work. But I think there's other issues that have to be addressed more in terms of the mandates that are causing the cost increases for small businesses. So for instance, higher minimum wage, paid family leave, other types of mandates really prevent a business owner from directing more of that income into salaries and being able to find and hire the workers that they need, as opposed to paying these mandates.
And I'm wondering about hiring for large corporations versus small businesses, right? And you're locked in here on small businesses. Is your point that those mandates are more of a burden for small businesses, or are they an issue you see writ large in the hiring process?
It's both overall. Big businesses deal with a lot of the same things that small businesses do. But I think it's just more a sensitive issue for small businesses, especially locally based small businesses, because we don't have the ability to spread those costs over thousands of workers. The typical NFIB member is between 1 and 9 employees. And so if there's a cost increase and it's something that they have to bear the burden of, specifically a mandate or wage increases or whatever it is, they don't have the ability to spread that out amongst thousands of workers. It really hits the bottom line a lot more for the small and independent business owners.
Clearly, workforce is a major issue for small businesses in the state. But what other issues do you see there? What other paramount issues do you see for small businesses in Hawaii?
Well, that could be a whole separate show. There's a number of concerns that small businesses have. Labor always is a big cost driver. And so if there's labor shortages or mandates that are put on businesses, that really drives up the cost. There's more online shopping, which obviously impacts our retailers and to some extent our restaurateurs. The concerns with how our number one industry, tourism, is being impacted, just because we don't have a lot of members that are in the hotel business, which is obviously affected by tourism. That doesn't mean that the add-on services or the other retail shops that tourists frequent aren't impacted by low tourism numbers. So there's a whole number of issues that are impacting small businesses, and it's really a concern right now. We could get into tariffs or other things too, but there's really a concern that small businesses are being impacted by things that are happening at the national level.
I was looking at some of the industries in the state that work with lobbyists, people like yourself that try to liaise between stakeholders and legislators to move things in one direction or another. And it seems like the NFIB
is one of the most prominent offices here in the state. I wonder if you could just talk about that. What goes into the sort of the size and the scope of what your office does, and maybe even just educate our listeners a little bit on the totality of the work that you do?
Sure. So NFIB is an organization nationally that's been around for over 80 years. There are offices in every state, obviously, because there's businesses that need advocacy in every state. And so we try and focus on the issues that impact small and independent businesses. Now, those can be very similar to just the business environment overall, and we work hand in hand with a number of other organizations. We align with a lot of the large businesses on a lot of issues. But it's something that there's a unique problems that small businesses face that we like to be the lead and try and tackle those issues so that the businesses can remain operating.
Is there anything I haven't asked you about the report or the work you do in general that you think it's important for our listeners to know?
I've noticed a trend of, you can say for the past decade or two decades or three decades, a lot of the mom and pop shops, the main street businesses that we've grown up really frequenting and loving, have had issues that have caused them to stop operating. Some of it can just be like the family business and the kids don't want to take over. But there can be other things that are driving these small businesses to stop operating. So I think we have to be very cognizant, especially as we're passing new laws, that we don't forget about the mom and pop shops. It could be your favorite restaurant or your favorite retailer. Some of these businesses that have been around for decades, they're really ingrained in the fabric of Hawaii. And if we lose those businesses or they're replaced by national chains, we don't have that same connection with those businesses.
Well, we really appreciate your perspective today, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for your time.
That was Michael Yosua, Hawaii State Director for the NFIB, talking about a recent small business jobs report. We'll have links to it on the website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
HPR is committed to sharing beautiful and inspiring music from Hawaii and around the world, and news that both informs and elevates local storytelling and ideas. We are moving forward together at 100% independent and fully backed by the community we serve. Your first time or upgraded monthly gift keeps the service free and coming your way every day. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
HPR is celebrating the season with special programming on HPR 1 and HPR 2. See the full lineup at hawaiipublicradio.org/holiday. Sponsored by Maui Fruit Jewels as a gift to the community.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Renewable Energy Services, based in Honoka'a on the Big Island, serving the community's solar energy needs since 1992.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Have you ever seen our endemic coot? It can be found in wetlands throughout the Hawaiian Islands. Despite its widespread territory, its small population numbers can make this bird hard to find. But we've got its call for you today, courtesy of the Macaulay Library at Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo's Patrick Hart with today's Manu Minute.
Ale keokeo, or Hawaiian coots, are water birds that are found on all the main Hawaiian islands except Kaho'olawe, and are endemic to Hawaii, meaning that they're found nowhere else in the world. They're also considered to be endangered, with less than 2,000 individuals left. About the size of a small duck, both male and female alae keokeo are mostly black with white bills and a prominent bright white shield above their bill. Unlike ducks, their toes are lobed instead of webbed, which allows them to better walk on land. Hawaiian coots are mainly found in coastal wetland areas, kalo fields, and aquaculture ponds where they eat a variety of aquatic plants, shellfish, and fish. In Hawaiian mythology, alae keokeo are known for their chattiness and harsh warning cries. Alae keokeo have a really interesting nesting behavior, where they often construct floating nests out of aquatic vegetation. This allows them to avoid many introduced mammalian predators such as dogs, cats, rats, and mongoose. A recent paper from a UH Manoa graduate student showed that predicted sea level rise from global warming will cause a significant reduction in their nesting and foraging habitat. However, this could be offset and even reversed if traditional indigenous farming techniques, such as the maintenance of lo'i for kalo, are expanded into former agricultural wetlands. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, supporting their communities, habitats, and wildlife. More about helping at friendsofoahunwr.org.
Hawaii Public Radio brings the community together through our multi-platform Live from the Atherton event series. From jazz to classical, Hawaii Public Radio showcases local musicians in an intimate studio setting. We also welcome authors to host readings and discussions about their work.
This is a story, a mo'olelo. It's not really my story, but it involves me. Sometimes as a subject, sometimes as an unwitting object, sometimes as an unwilling participant. A mo'olelo that does not involve the teller is almost worthless. Just about as worthless as a story that is only about the teller.
Can't join us in person? Watch previous performances online on hawaiipublicradio.org/watch.
This fall, Punahou School hosted a naturalization ceremony for 68 new citizens who took an oath and pledged allegiance to their new country, the United States of America. Punahou School's community got a front row seat as the roll call for immigrants from 21 countries was read off.
We have Brazil, China, Ethiopia, Hong Kong, Jamaica, Japan, Kenya, Laos, Nepal, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Nigeria, Portugal, Samoa, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, Turkey, the United Kingdom, Vietnam, and we do know our alphabet, the largest group today from the Philippines.
The ceremony was coordinated by Punahou's Junior ROTC program and the Davis Democracy Initiative. Started by attorney Mark Davis and his wife Janie, the Davis Family Foundation established a fund to develop curricula around issues of American democracy. The idea was hatched around the time of the pandemic, and working with Punahou President Mike Latham and educators David Ball and Pam Sakamoto, the program took off. Mark Davis dropped by our studios this week, along with Sakamoto, and spoke with the conversation's Catherine Cruz about finding a better way to teach democracy in action.
I think with the way we originally approached it was, do we need to rethink how we teach civics to our high school and even younger students? Because, of course, the world is such that often if you can involve students in experiential types of interchanges, whether it's through civic engagement or the interactions with mentors or people that are public policy people, is that a better way to understand the way our democracy works as opposed to the way it's conventionally taught with facts and figures and three branches of government, which is, of course, the way that we all learned civics. And we became convinced as we looked into this that this was being handled a little bit on the college level, but very little in terms of in curriculum development in the lower grades. And that's what Punahou became interested in, and they were able to contract with Pam Sakamoto and David Ball, who have become the creative movement behind the program. And then that's the way it started. It's about involving students in the processes of democracy, as opposed to just listening to lectures about what democracy is.
And, you know, I did talk to Dave about this, and Pam, maybe you can explain more, but yeah, you really want to engage them, right? Get them excited early on.
Oh, we do. And studies show that the earlier you introduce children or students to civics, the more naturally it becomes, and that they just take on the sense that they're part of the process and part of democracy. And that may be something that makes you smile, like around the presidential election, we went to the first grade and had them choose their menu for election day. And they had designed a ballot box, and they were learning to count in groups of five, and so they could vote and then count off the ballots and see which side won for which menu option. And they're all excited, right? And they're asking questions. And that's at a very young age. And if you can take the fourth graders to the legislature and have them interact with some of our representatives and see the action, they feel a part of it. And of course, by the time that they get to the high school level, they're really ready. And this year in particular, we're seeing grades 9 through 12 students really take up leadership. They've been attending guest speaker talks. They've been participating in activities, and now they're driving ideas and events. And that's exactly what we want to see happen over time.
When we talk about our country and the founding ideals upon which America is built on, the idea of the right to vote, those freedoms, those kinds of things. And I know Punahou hosted a naturalization ceremony there this year. Those are powerful experiences. And to get the students involved is a great thing.
Well, I mean, the naturalization ceremony is such a privilege. We work with the U.S. District Court. This year, Judge Watson officiated. The Immigration and Naturalization Service bring their staff and set everything up. And we had 68 new citizens from 21 countries. And we had our chorale and the Pacific Fleet Brass Band and the fifth grade singing the Pledge of Allegiance, and the entire theater on campus filled with families of the new citizens in addition to the new citizens and students from K through 12. And what a lesson in citizenship. And it's really moving. And the more we can work with public partners like the courts and the Department of Education and University of Hawaii and other groups, the better it is. So we seek to bring the Davis Democracy Initiative outside into the community as well.
And then, Mark, law's your thing. And to be able to bring folks so that they have a front row seat, what was that like for you?
It's one of the things that has really encouraged me about the way this program has progressed was that we have made these alliances with other institutions, like the law school, for example. They have something that's interesting, as they did a few weeks ago, about Japanese internment in Hawaii. We made sure that a group of the Punahou fellows were able to attend that. We have representatives from the faculty that will come and attend public forums, whether it's on affirmative action or civil rights matters or other things, that engages both the various institutions with whom we have become associated, but also it's something the students embrace as part of their learning process. So they are not only exposed to what the teachers tell them in the classroom, the experiences they have, but they're also exposed to a monumentally group of important people. We've had ambassadors and civil rights lawyers that have come and people that have talked about all of the pressing issues that you hear in public. And often at the time that we originally started talking about this, we had no conception how the world would unfold with regard to how these principles would be attacked. And now, of course, they seem even more viable and important. That has certainly resulted in the very strong feedback from the community. And part of the program is not only just to involve the Punahou students, it also, they've created this great relationship with the public school teachers, and they've had various convocations where public school teachers who are interested in understanding what Punahou is doing in terms of fashioning a civics education program so that they can adopt it in their various schools.
And so it's like a stone, the ripple effect.
Exactly. And we, our earliest discussions was we don't want this just to be for Punahou. We want to involve the community. We want to involve the public school system. We want the creativity that Punahou has applied to fashioning a new outlook at how you teach civics education to be something that is available to others to adopt.
We were talking to Chief Justice Rechtenwald, and he had talked about the day that they set aside for lawyers to reaffirm their vows, why they decided to become lawyers in the first place. Do you remember what led you on this path?
I do indeed. And I think that when a lot of the controversy arose when these law firms were being pressured to enter into arrangements, which for some of us thought it was a complete compromise of their oath they had taken the day they were sworn in to be lawyers, was concerning. And I think the Chief Justice said, you know what, we're going to have a day in which everybody comes down and takes the oath again to remind everybody what their responsibilities and their obligations are as lawyers to uphold the rule of law. And it was a great symbolic gesture. And it was something that, in the process of practicing law and doing businesses and worrying about stepping on toes and so on, it was something that needed to be emphasized to remind everybody why they were there and what their obligations were.
And then, Pam, in the headlines today, we have so much political violence. And I don't know how your students are feeling and what they're sharing with you in the classroom about when they see this. It's pretty horrific. But getting back to that civil discourse and being able to disagree, but respecting the other person's opinion.
I can't tell you how important we think that is, Catherine, that we can bring students together and that they can practice civil discourse. They can practice having a conversation about a difficult topic and agree to disagree. And one way that we try to do that is to bring speakers who do model that, who have very different points of view, but have a mutual respect and expertise, and that they can be in conversation with each other and then take questions from the audience, and that students can see that this is possible. Because, yes, our students are growing up in a time of polarization. And if this is all they know, because they are so young and they are coming of age where they are all digital natives, they have had smartphones with the rapid dissemination and misinformation and disinformation over time, they need to see people modeling civility, and they need to learn to do it themselves. And it doesn't necessarily come naturally, but it feels good. And I think this is something that our teachers are also interested in. And the Davis Democracy Initiative sponsored professional development with a group led by Diana Hess, who came as our resident expert last year. And she was a longtime dean at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and above all, researcher for decades. And how do you teach talking about difficult subjects in the classroom rather than avoiding them because they make people uncomfortable? And we have to talk about these things. Otherwise, we're going to be siloed. So that's one of our missions as well.
where do you see this expanding? I was at a forum recently where they talked about a news desert and how good information is sadly not as good as it used to be. And with AI and fake news out there, there's just this fear that we're going to have to work harder to make sure that our students are critical thinkers.
I think that's true. I think that one of the real challenges today is that so many of our students get their news through social media. And part of the program is to be able to decipher, which they call media literacy, the ability to understand what is true and what is false and how they can come to conclusions in a world in which they've been hammered with the concept that there are no facts to agree on. And that is a very big challenge. But I think it's something that is manageable. A lot of people do it, and they have to figure out how they can decipher the deluge of misinformation and try to decipher truth, which is sometimes elusive.
And is there anything else? I don't know if there are any teachers out there in any of the public schools, if they're interested in learning more about what Punahou is doing and how they can start their own little initiatives in their schools.
Oh, we would love to speak with them, meet with them in any way that's convenient, welcome them to campus. And we do find that working with individual teachers works out really well. We can arrange events. We can help bring them to campus or meet them there. We're eager to develop more partnerships. We're better together. And Punahou also has a mission as a private school with a public purpose, and the Davis Democracy Initiative is very much part of that. We would be delighted to speak with anybody who would like to reach us, my colleague Dave Ball. We're a team, and we look forward to talking with people.
And then, Mark, I don't know, you've been to all these events. Do you recall a time when you maybe sat there in the audience and you just thought, yeah, I feel good about what we're doing?
I think I get that. When I have a interchange with the students, or I hear a presentation by a student, or I'm contacted, as I often am when I go to these events, from people coming up to me and identifying them as a democracy fellow and explaining to them how this has been an impact on their outlook and what they're doing. And if there's anything that's optimistic in this troubled world of public engagement, it's that. And I think my wife and I, when we go to these things, we just, you know, there's a glimmer of hope that what we're doing is right and the message is getting through.
That was Honolulu attorney Mark Davis and Punahou's Pam Sakamoto talking about the Davis Democracy Initiative. The program aims to develop curricula to teach about American democratic ideals and why, in these times of increased polarization and growing political violence, it's important to teach civil discourse in our schools. We have to go, but up tomorrow we highlight a LGBTQ love story set in Hawaii and the Philippines and filmed at Ilocano. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.